thing. And I did say in one time that Gaza has been the largest open air prison in the world. Now it has become, with the closure of the two border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, and Gaza and Israel, now it has become a prison cell with no window.
Yusuf, we have less than a minute to go. If you can talk about what needs to happen right now. The government media office has just released a statement warning the delay in response to the relief appeal is turning the besieged enclave into a mass grave.
Be done immediately. We need to stop all of these massacres happening around us, and we need a longer-term solution. We cannot keep finding ourselves in this circle of violence. If I can keep calculate for an hour that what I witnessed from the escalation, 2012, 2008, 2014, 2021, and I can keep calculating even the small escalation between them. We need a longer-term solution. The international community and the world leaders should stand ahead their responsibilities, ensuring a longer-term solution for Palestinians who lives in Gaza. It start by immediate stop for this war, and then lifting the blockade and finding a longer-term solution for us. This is unacceptable. We cannot keep finding ourselves. They made us feel useless in front of our children. I agree with my neighbors, but what we are going through is traumatizing us, and I really believe we need years to recover from what's going on now. This has to stop immediately.
Yusuf Hamash is advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Masab Abu Toha is a Palestinian poet and author. We'll link to his new piece in the Washington Post, "In Gaza, No One Can Believe Their Eyes." Coming up, we go to Tel Aviv to speak to a leading Israeli human rights attorney. Back in 30 seconds.
نان يا حبة عيني عندي هيك نامل عندلي نامل يما نومة طرية سلانك مية ولا حليب نام يا حبة مني مش غريب نام يا أما نوم طريق
A Mother's Lullaby by Sabreen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
To talk more about the Israeli assault on Gaza, the siege, and Hamas's shocking attack on Israel, we're joined by longtime Israeli human rights lawyer Michael Sfard. He's an expert on international human rights and international laws of war. He represents Palestinian and Israeli activists and human rights organizations. He's also the author of the book, The Wall and the Gate, Israel, Palestine, and the Legal Battle for Human Rights. His new op-ed on Haaretz is titled, Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils. Michael Sfard joins us in Tel Aviv, Israel. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael, and welcome to Democracy Now! If you could talk about your piece that you wrote for Haaretz, Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils.
Well, good morning to you, and thank you very much for having me. These are terrible, terrible days. Actually, quite a nightmare that we're living through, and my heart goes out to the previous interviewees from Gaza. We have experienced a shock. I have to mediate to you the sentiment in the Israeli public, in the Israeli society. The attack on Saturday was a savage attack. Targeting civilians, going from one house to another in civilian neighborhoods and killing, murdering women, children, and elderly and innocent people, and also in the scene of the party, killing hundreds of people, and the blood boils. And the blood boils. It's not just that the blood boils, but also one feels a puncture in the heart, a hole in the stomach. And now the question is, what do you do with that? With this, confronting this inhuman attack? Do you feel the punctured heart and the hole in your belly with cement, with concrete? Or do you fill it with the warmth of compassion? And I'm afraid to say that many Israelis are extremely filled with rage and desire for revenge. And I, as a human rights lawyer, and in the last three decades, I have been working tirelessly, dedicating my professional career to protect the rights of everyone, and especially Palestinian communities who are under occupation, under a regime of apartheid, and under the very cruel blockade in Gaza. The only way that I know is to put a cry to adhere to the norms of international law. And I have to say, I want to shout, but I understand that at this time there is very little space for a voice like that. And when I hear the leaders of the State of Israel and the generals, and their rhetoric suggests that things that in the past they denied that the Israeli army is doing in the cycle of attacks on Gaza is now almost probably an official policy, targeting en masse inhabited areas, starving people as a method of warfare. I mean, if what Hamas has done was a blatant war crime, and I mean, the legal term is war crime, but in fact, it's a crime against humanity, not in the legal sense, but in the moral sense. It was an attack on everything that is human. To take hostage women with their children, elderly men and women on wheelchairs. This is just incomprehensible. But now my government is waging an attack that seems to be using war crimes to retaliate on war crimes, and this is definitely not what should be done now.
As a lawyer, as an Israeli, as a Jewish human rights lawyer, can you talk about what collective punishment means legally and morally? I mean, I think about the Pittsburgh synagogue, which was the worst killing of Jews in the United States in many years, this brutal attack this weekend, the worst killing of Jews since the Holocaust. But the idea of the response being to attack an area of land that is the home to over 2 million people, in this case, 2 million Palestinians. If you can explain, when the shooter shot up the Pittsburgh synagogue, they didn't destroy U.S. authorities, his community, his neighborhood. They went after him. They tried him. Michael Sefard, can you respond?
Yes. I mean, every human moral system that I know rejects collective punishment, more definitely modern ones, but also we find it in the Bible that children should not bear the spoiled fruits that their fathers have eaten. I mean, there are many commandments even in the Bible, which is a very old system of norms. That says that people should individually be found responsible for crimes that they are committing. And of course, international law, modern international law, prohibits, with no exception, collective punishment. We have very clear language written into the Fourth Hague Regulations of 1907 and in the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. But I don't think I need to reference to international treaties. It is something that each and every one of us has to have as an instinct, as a moral basic principle people should bear responsibility for their deeds and not their neighbors and not their people and not their sisters or brothers or mothers or fathers. And it's not the first time that Gazans are paying the price for things that are done by Hamas or by other groups in the Palestinian society. And not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. I mean, this is abhorrent, but this is exactly what's going on. And under international law, it's a war crime to inflict collective punishment, definitely on civilians.
Michael, I mean, more Israeli citizens were killed Saturday than during the entire Second Intifada of 2000 to 2005. As Amy mentioned, more Jewish people were killed than 1,300, over 1,300 since the Holocaust. Tony Blinken, a Secretary of State, speaking earlier today, invoked the experience of his stepfather who survived the concentration camps of Auschwitz and Dachau. Now, if you could say, you've said, you know, it's very important to understand the context under which Hamas's attack took place. Do you believe in Israel or elsewhere there are enough people coming out with your position condemning both Hamas's attack as well as the occupation and Israel's response in Gaza?
There are people in Israel that that feel that have the same sentiment that I've voiced in my op-ed and I'm expressing here, but I have to be honest. I mean, we're experiencing now a huge setback. I don't know when there will be space for these kind of messaging in Israel or in Palestine, for that matter. When the blood boils, people choose and this is probably a human feature, but it's not a good one. Humans have many, many good features, but they have a lot of bad ones, and this is a bad one. They want revenge, as if a revenge would bring back the dear ones that are gone. And yes, I in reference to the Holocaust, people in Israel have a very special mental vocabulary. And the events of Saturday have immediately triggered the scenes of pogroms in Russia and Ukraine of the 19th century and of course, the Holocaust. And the threat of annihilation, which is of course irrational because we have an army that had a huge, huge collapse, and of course one that would be investigated, and an amazing failure. And yet, the Israeli army is strong, and Israel is not under a threat of annihilation. And yet, this is exactly what people feel, and one have to understand that in order to understand the Israeli sentiment. People are feeling under threat of annihilation, and that is a part of our collective psychology. It's not just benign. It's not just something that we've grown into by chance. It's something that is injected and indoctrinized from early age. I'm not different in that sense. I mean, I have to struggle with making these comparisons, and that allows the Israeli government and the Israeli army to do stuff that are just that people should, in a normal circumstance, object to.
How do you respond, Michael Sefard, when you bring up the occupation, not as a justification for what happened this weekend, but saying that it is essential to understand and to resolve at this point that these are not two equal nations where one invaded another? In the midst of all of this, Israel is responsible for what happens in the West Bank and Gaza.
Yes, Amy, context is important, but I want to pause for a moment and say context is important in order to understand the root causes and in order to think of what is the way out, what is the way forward. But sometimes context is brought as a means to mitigate the horrific nature of what has happened. So while I am ready and I will say some things about context, I do wish to say that what we've seen on Saturday has no justification whatsoever. It's a crime, it's inhuman, and this is something that, because every abhorrent crime in humanity's history has a context, of course. So having said that, yes, Gaza is under occupation, and it's not just any occupation. It's an occupation coupled with a cruel blockade that put more than 2.5 million people for more than a decade and a half in a closed up area where Israel controls most borders and the airspace and the goods that flow in and the people that go in and out, and Israel retains Gaza on the verge of suffocation. And this is inhuman. And by the way, in the line of those responsible for this blockade, Israel stands first. But the line is long, and it includes the Western world that allows it. I can't recall any other context in which the international community and the Western powers allowed such a blockade on millions of innocent people and not came over with a plan to end it. So occupation, and yes, Israel is the strong power here, and yes, Israel is the one that maintains that blockade. And if you look in the last decade and a half, it seemed like there was no reason for Israel to change its policy. America was fine with it. Europe was fine with it. The UN didn't do much about it. And I just hope, from this very deep pit that we're in, that we will start now to, I mean, we're now in the eye of the storm. So it is too early to say where we're heading. But I, you know, I don't pray. I'm not a religious person. But I desire that maybe from this calamity, we will start crawling out of that pit. And we can try to do all these, trying to go through different roads. Eventually, the roadmap is right before us. It's international law, it's justice and human rights and respect for the dignity of all people and for their rights and for their collective rights, for the right of self-determination. There will be no end for this, no end to bloodshed. There will be no end to the conflict without adhering to the principles that humanity has adopted throughout its long, scarred history of man-made catastrophes.
And Michael, we have less than a minute, but if you could say something, sorry to interrupt you, about the status of the Israeli hostages who've been taken by Hamas. What do you know about them, and what do you expect will happen? What do you know about what might happen?
One of the terrible things about the hostages situation is that Hamas would not provide any information about their condition, and that is an abuse, a psychological abuse for the families. I heard all kinds of statements threatening to hurt them, to kill them. This is I know very little, and unfortunately, my friends in Gaza, who are human rights, my colleagues in Gaza, I'm not in. I fear for them too, and I don't know how they are, if they are safe, if they are alive. This is I just want to end with the following. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was a Holocaust survivor. She hid in the Warsaw Ghetto and then in the Aryan side of Warsaw for several years with her mother and sister. And she wrote an autobiography where she wrote that probably the biggest challenge in the face of inhumanity, of being a victim of inhumanity, is to retain your own humanity. That's the biggest challenge. And in this area, there are so many victims. And the challenge is that those victims that went through living hell will retain their humanity.
Michael Savard, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli human rights lawyer. We're going to link to your new article for Haaretz titled Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, we speak with a Palestinian journalist, Amjad Iraqi. Stay with us. Once Upon a City by Farah Suleiman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Palestinians and Israelis have grown accustomed to wars in the South in recent years, but the war that began in the early hours of Saturday, 7th October, is nothing like the others. Those are the opening lines of a new piece in the London Review of Books by our next guest, the Palestinian journalist Amjad Iraqi, who joins us now from London. The article is headlined, Get Out of There Now. Amjad is senior editor at 972 magazine and a policy member of Al-Shabaka. His latest piece for 972 is headlined, A Psychological Barrier Has Been Shattered in Israel-Palestine. Welcome to Democracy Now! Amjad, thank you so much for joining us. If you could explain why you think this invasion is different from the past, the 7th October one, and what psychological barrier has been broken.
Thank you all for having me. I think there's no doubt that in many respects what we've been witnessing over the past couple of days is what is being described as a game changer. And there are two ways to kind of think about this. One is this kind of material and military shift that has just occurred by the fact that Hamas broke out of the Gaza Strip, a besieged enclave, both in terms of targeting the military infrastructure, but also the massacres that happened in these Israeli southern towns that has really not only kind of broken this assumption of Gaza as this place that could maintain Palestinians and engage Hamas, but has really shaken this psychological barrier that exists in Israeli society and the Israeli establishment, that the occupation is somehow sustainable, and that if they just keep enforcing the institutions of apartheid, that if they keep pounding Hamas and the Gaza Strip as often as possible, that somehow that is actually going to bring them security, that is going to bring safety. And through that, they can then continue to claim that Israel is a democracy, that Israel is a safe place for the Jewish people. And what we've witnessed with these atrocities that have happened is a complete shattering of that. It is broken to Israeli society that the Palestinians are not some distant problem, and that they cannot keep having the boot of their military apparatus upon them. Unfortunately, as Michael was referring to earlier, I'm not sure how much this will have a lot of soul searching and reflection, as right now we are seeing this complete desire to inflict total revenge on the Gaza Strip, from the political establishment to the media all the way down. But I think that barrier that existed in the minds of Israeli society and the Israeli state, that this system could work, I think has really been broken by this assault.
You write, Amjad, in your Plus 972 piece that these events will allow the most extremist elements within Netanyahu's far-right administration to carry out as much of their agenda as possible. Can you respond in particular to what the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and the national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, convicted of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting hatred against Palestinians, what they want to happen now? And if you think that will become the dominant actions of the Netanyahu government, the war government, as they're calling it right now, bringing in others into the government as well at this point?
So for it's no secret that the Israeli government now is really primarily being led by a gang of far-right demagogues who have been very explicit for years, even before they arrived in office, about their ambitions for the Palestinians as a whole. And we're seeing that being put out in full force over the past few months since the government has been in place through the enabling and almost overt support of settler pogroms against West Bank towns and villages, and what is now eventually leading to the total expulsion of numerous Palestinian hamlets and people in order to make way for even more settler outposts and to even pave the way for more assertion of what they describe as Israeli sovereignty. We've been seeing this really being expedited in full force. And now for the far-right government, this massacre, as atrocious as it is for them a historic opportunity. It is for them reinforcing this idea that the only solution to what they regard as the Gaza problem is either the complete mass destruction of the Strip, or to try to eliminate rather than merely contain Hamas's political and military apparatus. And if possible, and this is really one of the most horrific potentials, is the potential that this moment could be used to try to expel masses of Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip. The far-right ministers are very explicit about this ambition, and they really are trying to mobilize Israeli institutions in order to implement that process. And while we're still in the throes of the storm, but we're already seeing that first demand on their wish list being implemented in a way that our Palestinian colleagues from Gaza were just describing. And there's a massive mutual interest, not just on the part of the far-right politicians, but also the Israeli military, which has been really humiliated by this massive breach of the Gaza fences, by Hamas completely subverting its intelligence or its appearance of being able to know at all times what Hamas is doing. Because of this shattering, the Israeli military also arguably is in line with the political establishment of what to do with this. And time will tell where this leads, but we're already seeing this indulgence of revenge, not just from the Israeli institutions themselves, but also the international community, including the United States, which is basically telling Israel to go ahead and to actually justify that revenge and removing the political context without necessarily having to excuse the massacres, which they should not, but to nonetheless realize that there is no military solution to this issue. And the real problem in the end is this wider apartheid regime that is activating even when you don't have a war around Gaza, that is activating even on your so quote-unquote calm. And this is the bigger issue that needs to be addressed.
And Amjad, we just have a minute, but if you could say, you know, everybody says, as you said, this was unprecedented that Hamas broke through this barrier. People say, you know, they've been planning this attack for a long time. What statement have they made since this military assault on Gaza began? And what do you know of what they're doing with the hostages and whether they're willing to release them in exchange for Gaza getting some basic resources?
It's quite hard to say what the end game is entirely. In many ways, the assault also probably surprised them as much as it did the Israelis. And right now, I think it seems like they're trying to figure out what kind of bargaining chips they have in order to gain certain new kinds of agreements with the Israeli authorities, with the aid potentially of Arab states to try to mediate some kind of ceasefire that helps to meet certain Hamas demands. And they've been quite explicit about some of the things that they're seeking, which are longstanding issues that have existed even before this far-right government, including the issue of release of Palestinian prisoners, including provocations and aggressions around Jerusalem, especially around the holy sites, and also, of course, what's been happening in the West Bank under the Israeli occupation and settler violence. So these are kind of the big structural demands that are still at play, and it seems that Hamas is now trying to use tactically basically what they have right now to kind of turn the tables.
Because we're
still seeing the midst of this, it's very hard to know where this is leading.
Palestinian journalist Amjad Iraqi, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m., and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. Hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD Channel 7014 or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge and be inspired.